And welcome to another exciting episode of Battleground Florida. I am Christopher Heath. Our guest today is Niles Edward Francis. He is a contributor over at Decision Desk HQ. And, you know, those of us who stay up all night watching election returns come in, there's only a couple sites we actually really keep an eye on. And Decision Desk is one of the best. Their data is fantastic when votes start rolling in for you to be able to track what's happening and see where things are going and which counties are reporting and which states. Just a great treasure trove of information on election night when things tend to be going haywire. And I mean, it's 2020. Is anybody here sitting here saying we're going to have a smooth election? It's going to be a bumpy ride. And I think we're going to be okay at the very end of it. But, you know, for those of us old enough to remember Mr. Toad's Wild Ride out at Disney when it still existed at Walt Disney World, still exists out at Disneyland if you're out in Los Angeles, but it kind of like that. So it'll be fun. It'll be interesting. So anyway, he's out of Atlanta, Georgia. So we're talking about an adjacent state to Florida, but a state that suddenly is a battleground, or at least auditioning to be one. Hi, Niles. Welcome to the podcast. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate this.
So you're up in Hotlanta? Is that where you're at?
Hotlanta. Atlanta, yes. That's where I am, Atlanta.
We were discussing having you on, and you're like, oh, two battleground states. I'm like, well, we'll pump the brakes there, you know? Just because the polls show things tight in Georgia, don't come at me in Florida and tell me you're a battleground state.
Yeah, I know. I shouldn't lecture a Floridian about being in a battleground state.
But it is interesting. I mean, you guys have a, obviously, the presidential race up there is close. Mm-hmm. There's one Senate race that looks really close. It's the Ossoff race. And then that other one is wide open because it's kind of more of a primary, so to speak. So you got a lot going on up there.
You're telling me. Yeah, it's a lot going on up here in Georgia. Georgia has never, ever been in the national spotlight like this before. Like, I've observed elections before, but not as closely as I have this year and in years past. But like in years past, I would just like watch the coverage of elections on TV and things like that. And I'd see all sorts of TV ads, like, you know, campaign ads and things like that. And I've, you know, this is my first time actually voting in an election, and I've never seen anything like this before. Like, you know, Georgia, every commercial break on over-the-air television is campaign ads, campaign ads, campaign ads. Like, it's crazy.
the voting thing, for those who don't know, it's not that you've just been lazy your whole life. This is the first time you've been legally old enough to vote.
Correct. This is the first time I'm, you know, allowed to vote. I used to go to the polls with my mother, like in 2012, when Obama was running for re-election. She took me and my sister to the polls with her so we could watch her cast her vote for President Obama. And it, like, you know, I've done things like that before, but I've never actually touched the screen myself. So it was kind of surreal to actually get to do it myself, you know.
Okay, so you're a polling and numbers guy. You're a contributor over at Decision Desk, who they do some just, they're one of the ones I keep up on election night because their data comes in so crisp, so quick. But yeah, you're a numbers guy. So let's talk some numbers.
Get into it.
Is Georgia legitimately, I mean, could Biden win Georgia?
Yes, he could. He absolutely could. Like Georgia is a state that should be in firmly in President Trump's column. It's not. He has polled, like, you know, consistently the polls between Trump and Biden in Georgia have been within the margin of error. And I think the Trump campaign is well aware of how competitive Georgia is. They've made several campaign stops in Georgia lately. Like last Friday, his oldest son, Donald Trump Jr., was in, I think he was in Macon. And that's, of course, where President Trump last held his last rally in Georgia. That's the rally where Senator Perdue, like, you know, kind of mispronounced Kamala Harris's name. But yeah, Georgia, like, you know, the president and his team are well aware of how competitive Georgia is. As a matter of fact, Ivanka Trump was here as well a few weeks ago. She held a kind of like a joint event with Senator David Perdue. They kind of like held like a fundraiser at some sort of pizza place in North Metro Atlanta. I think it was in like Sandy Springs, somewhere like that. But yeah, his team is well aware of how competitive Georgia is. And the fact that it's not firmly in President Trump's column signals that Biden has a really good chance of flipping the state. And he's going to be here tomorrow, Vice President Biden. He's going to be here tomorrow. So, like, you know, they know that Georgia is on the map and they're taking it very seriously.
What are the dynamics there? I know here in Florida, we talk about how there's like five different chunks of Florida and you've got to play in all of them. What are the dynamics? Is it basically Atlanta versus the rest of the state, or how does Georgia shape up?
Pretty much it's Atlanta versus the rest of the state. In states like others, like take Arizona, for example. Arizona, you have Phoenix and then you have the rest of the state. Georgia's kind of like the same way. Like you have Atlanta and you have the rest of the state. So Biden winning Georgia would it would hinge on his margins in various metro Atlanta suburban counties and juicing up minority turnout in some of these majority black neighborhoods and precincts. And Trump winning Georgia would require he would have to cut into Vice President Biden's numbers among black voters, particularly black men, and he would have to run up the score in rural Georgia. So both of the candidates, they have to work really hard over the next 8 days to try to make a play for the Peach State, and it's going to be very exciting. So like I said, I've observed elections before and I've never seen anything like this.
I mean, what are we talking about when you say in Metro Atlanta? Is that like Fulton County, or what are the counties like on election night? What counties are you going to be watching and saying, if Joe Biden hits 60% here, he's in good shape. If he can't, we can pack it up.
So I'll talk to you a little bit about one county that you've probably heard a lot about by now, and that I've been fascinated by, Gwinnett County. Gwinnett County is a diversifying suburban county northeast of Atlanta. At the start of the decade, it was majority white. Now it's majority non-white. It's kind of like it's kind of like a mixture. It has like a mixture of everything. It has Asians, it has blacks, Indians, Latinos, whites. It has a little bit of everything. So in 2012, it voted for Mitt Romney by like 9 or 10 points. And in 2016, it flipped to Hillary Clinton. That was one of those counties where the suburban shift was kind of taking place pre-Trump. I think that's Gwinnett County is a perfect example of that. Now, in 2018, we had the blockbuster governor race between Stacey Abrams and Brian Kemp. Stacey Abrams got like 56, 57% of the vote in Gwinnett County. So it's trended left at a very, very fast pace. And I feel like Vice President Biden would need to get like 60% of the vote in Gwinnett County if he wants to be in a good shape statewide. It's like, you also have a competitive congressional race in Gwinnett County. You have the 7th district race. It's an open seat. The Republican incumbent, a guy named Rob Woodall, he was elected in 2010, never faced a competitive reelection before up until 2018, where he won by just less than 500 votes. Now he's retiring and it's an open seat, and his Democratic opponent that year was named was a professor at Georgia State University. Her name is Carolyn Bordeaux. She is now running for the open seat, and Democrats are increasingly confident that they're going to flip that seat. So that's a district that voted for Mitt Romney by like 20 something percentage points, and it dropped to like Trump plus 6 or 7. And that's a district that could very well flip from Trump to Biden. So, you have a lot going on in Gwinnett County, and I think it kind of I think Gwinnett County is, how like Fairfax County, Virginia has it's pretty blue. It has like all those government employees, and it's a pretty blue county up in Virginia. I think Gwinnett County is headed in that direction.
What are the various metric, not metrics, but like the systems there in Georgia? How quickly are we going to get numbers out of Georgia on election night?
Well, Georgia, I do not expect to know the winner on election night. Like in the primary, it took us until like the next day or that following Thursday after the primary for most of the key races to be called. So I don't expect, because we're going to see a surge in turnout this year. Turnout, last I checked, turnout was already at 2.7 million, and that's just early in absentee votes. Like the Georgia Secretary of State is estimating 5 million, a turnout of 5 million. And if turnout on election day is we're going to get election day votes. We're going to get election day votes. It's a matter of opening and scanning all those mail-in ballots. That's going to take some time. So I don't expect to know the winner on election night. I expect it to, Georgia law requires the Secretary of State to certify election results 10 days after the election. 10 days after the election. So I expect to know something before then, but I would say that we would probably know all of Georgia, the winners of all of Georgia's key races by at the latest Thursday or Friday, depending on how close some of them are.
Georgia reminds me, if I'm looking at the map, and you already brought up Arizona, which I think is a great example of another state that's in play and for kind of the same reasons. The other one I'm looking at is North Carolina, a same kind of thing where you're seeing this real urban-rural divide where whether or not the suburbs and the exurbs trend this way or that way a couple of points really hinges on the whole state and where it'll ultimately end up. And it's also kind of these are other states that are we're looking at them and we're saying, could they go in the direction of, like, let's say Virginia, which 10 years ago was an absolute battleground, and this year nobody's even paying attention to it.
No.
Missouri's the same way, just the opposite direction. I remember when Missouri was, I mean, it was hard fought. Claire McCaskill won her race, and then now we're not even talking about the Show Me State because it's so far into the GOP column. So Georgia, Arizona, and North Carolina really strike me as being those three states that we're looking at and saying, are we going to see a reversion to the mean, or is it going to continue to progress in the direction it's headed? And this election will tell us a lot about all three.
Yeah, North Carolina is a pretty polarized state. Like, it's always decided by, like, close margins, like, in either direction. So North Carolina, it will be interesting to see how polls in North Carolina have Vice President Biden leading. So it's a swings. It's a pretty tough state. Like, like the thing that sets Georgia aside from North Carolina is Georgia has like North Carolina doesn't have many counties that are completely suburban. Like, Georgia has Cobb County, Gwinnett County, Henry County. North Carolina really doesn't, to my knowledge, North Carolina doesn't really have anything like have any counties that are, kind of similar to that in that dynamic. So, like, you have Wake County and you have Mecklenburg County, but those are predominantly urban. So you don't have really many in North Carolina. You don't have many counties that are, 100% suburban. So.
And then that's another race where, kind of like Georgia and also like Arizona, where you do have a very competitive Senate race, which can either help or hurt the top of the ticket. Because we tend to believe, and I think the data, at least recently in elections, shows there's not a lot of ticket splitting anymore. If you show up to vote for President Trump, you're probably also checking the box for Martha McSally. And you can run that across for Tom Tillis over in North Carolina as well. But Tillis has not been seen as a very strong candidate. He barely won when he won his first election in 2014. So, maybe a weak GOP candidate there. McSally just lost in 2018. Then she gets appointed. Now she's running to hold the seat again. Maybe not a super strong candidate that hurts the top of the ticket. But if you have somebody like we talked about the Texas poll that just came out, John Cornyn, for whatever people think of him, is a really good campaigner. Knows how to organize a staff. He's been at this a long time, and maybe he's somebody that in Texas he can outrun the president and help along the president to carry Texas, which it increasingly looks like the president will, although maybe not by the margin he had. So you are seeing some of these, kind of grouping of if a Senate candidate's strong, it helps the top of the ticket. If a Senate candidate's weak, it might hurt the top of the ticket.
Yes, so like on that note, like a lot of these senators who were elected in 2014, a lot of them are just not strong candidates. A lot of them have just turned out to be very generic, and they don't know how to run in competitive races. Like I'll use Joni Ernst as an example. Joni Ernst in 2014, she was seen as like she was the hottest thing in town in 2014. Like she came out with that Make 'Em Squeal ad, riding a motorcycle. She was seen as kind of like a like the future of the Republican Party. Now she's locked in this increasingly tough re-election battle, and mind you, Iowa has not ousted an incumbent senator in like forever. Like the last time an Iowa senator was ousted, like the last senator from Iowa to defeat an incumbent was Tom Harkin. So it's been forever since an incumbent was defeated, an incumbent senator was defeated in Iowa. And Joni Ernst, she's looking like she's headed down that path. So it's kind of interesting. Like Gary Peters in Michigan is the same way. Granted, Biden will likely win Michigan and will likely carry him like over the finish line, but like Peters in 2014, he faced weak Republican opposition. Now he's facing strong Republican opposition, like facing millions of dollars in outside spending, and like polls in Michigan, like a lot of people in Michigan really can't say anything about him. No one really knows who he is. So no one really knows who he is. So I think he's having trouble trying to navigate the the landscape of a competitive race. And since you're from Florida, I'll use Bill Nelson as another example. Bill Nelson, when he was first elected to the Senate, he was elected in 2000. Since then, in 2018, there were a lot of people in Florida who had recently moved to Florida who were not in Florida when Bill Nelson was first elected. So he had to reintroduce himself to thousands of Floridans who did not live there when he was first elected, and he had trouble doing that, and it ended up costing him. So I think we're seeing a lot of these senators in changing states, diversifying states like Georgia, North Carolina, Arizona, Florida. A lot of them are just having trouble navigating competitive races. So.
No, and the Nelson thing, you bring up a great point. Florida, we remember there was all the talk of 2018 being this blue wave, and when it all finally got counted, it really turned out to be a blue wave, except Florida. And Harry Enten, who used to be over at 538 and now is over at CNN, he had a tweet out, I think last night, talking about how we could very easily see everything play out the same way in this election, where there is a blue wave and all these down ballot Democrats do very well, yet Trump wins Florida. And because Florida, we're our own ecosystem down here. it's its own thing. And the Trump campaign, listen, when you talk to them, they don't necessarily come out and say this, but they do hint at it. They like to bring up the fact that this is now the president's home state. And, you can tell that there's a pride factor for them of they want to win Florida. And I wonder kind of if that comes at the expense of not competing in other places, but this is kind of the map that they've got. There's no path forward without Florida.
Yeah, well, part of it also stems from the fact that they have very little money. You can't compete in all of these battleground states if you don't have the money to do it. Like, we're seeing Vice President Biden, he's seen us. He started off the campaign, a fundraising slouch. He started off flat broke. Now here he is breaking fundraising records, and he's spending it all across the battleground map. The Trump campaign, on the other hand, is the reverse. They started off breaking fundraising records and shattering fundraising records. Now they are flat broke. Now they're really hedging all of their bets on Florida, because you're right, the president has no path without Florida. So we're seeing them spend all of this money in Florida because they, like you said, they really have no path to 270 without Florida. Also, I think when it comes to Florida, I think Vice President Biden, I don't think he's going to get Clinton's numbers in counties like Miami-Dade or Broward. I don't think he's going to get those numbers with Hispanics or Cubans. But I think he's going to make up for that in counties like Duval and Pinellas with all these older white voters who, we've seen in polls lately that older white voters have kind of been moving from President Trump to Vice President Biden. So it'll be interesting to see if that plays out. I think his coalition, Biden's coalition, if he does win Florida, or regardless, I think his coalition will look a lot similar to Bill Nelson's than Hillary Clinton's. We saw Bill Nelson do better with, we saw him do better with older white voters and lag with Cubans and Hispanics, whereas Hillary Clinton was the opposite. She did better with Cubans and Hispanics and lagged with older white voters. So I think Vice President Biden's coalition, given the polls that we've seen, Pinellas County, he's up by double digits in Pinellas County. I don't know if that's true, but we'll see in a couple of days. But if he's up in Pinellas County, then I think if he's up in Pinellas County by double digits, I think he's going to do well in Florida. So
you ticked off two of the three counties I'm going to be watching next Tuesday. One is, of course, Pinellas. That's St. Petersburg. And then the other one you mentioned was Duval, which is correctly pronounced Duval. You gotta drag it out for at least a minute and a half, which is where Jacksonville is. Lenny Curry is the Republican mayor. It's a county that Democrats have not traditionally won, but it's been close. It did back Andrew Gillum in 2018, although he lost the state. And then the other one being right here in Central Florida, and that's Seminole County. Seminole County and Pinellas, I put kind of in the same basket, and here's why. Both of them backed Donald Trump, but he didn't crest 50% in either county. He beat Hillary Clinton in both of them, but he didn't get over 50%. Then 2 years later, both of them narrowly backed both Bill Nelson and Andrew Gillum. So when you look at those two, they're very similar in demographics. They're very similar in, Pinellas is adjacent to Hillsborough County and Seminole's adjacent to Orange County. So They're kind of next to big blue counties, and you start to see this realignment and this shift. On election night, if we're starting to get those numbers and Pinellas is coming in at 55, 56 for Biden, it looks good for him. If it's coming in at 60 plus, it looks really good. If he's winning, but with 50, 51, you know, now you're wondering. And you mentioned the senior vote. The Trump campaign, again, they know that they've got work to do. You know, 2 weeks ago, he's in Ocala, 20 miles from the Villages for a rally. 1 week later, he's in the Villages for a rally. And, you know, it's a pure senior population there, but he's got to get those margins. He was plus 17 with seniors in Florida in 2016. I think University of North Florida had a poll that had him plus 10. That 7-point difference is, I mean, it is everything in a state that has not picked a president and given them more than 51% of the vote since George W. Bush's reelection. It's tight.
Yeah, Florida, you have, like, you know, any type of swing in Florida is significant because Florida is always decided by these close and narrow margins. So any sort of underperformance or overperformance in a state like Florida is particularly significant. But yeah, we're going to see, like, you know, Florida, and we're seeing this across the country as well. Like, we're seeing Vice President Biden make all of these inroads with older white voters. I think part of that has to stem from how the president's messaging has been on the coronavirus pandemic. Like, you know, his campaign and the president himself have been saying, like, you know, oh, only old people get it, only old people will die from it. I don't think that message kind of resonates with senior voters. So I think that's part of why we're seeing Vice President Biden do so well with seniors.
And listen, you and I both remember 2016, and you know, it was one of those elections where, you know, I think we look back at it with conventional wisdom and say, you know, there were indications out there that Hillary Clinton had some structural problems. She was winning, but she wasn't above 50%. Here in Florida, there were several times in the RCP, Real Clear Politics average, where Donald Trump took the lead over the summer and into the fall, and then she would get back ahead. And we kind of glossed all over that when we went into the elections. I think that there was a belief that, yeah, things are tight, but gravity will take hold, and there's no way that, you know, this outsider from New York, who's basically known as a reality TV star, is going to get elected. And then he did. And so now we're all looking at these polls coming out, and we're saying, could history repeat itself? And I think, listen, it absolutely could, because if you see a white, non-college educated vote increase across the country, I mean, it throws everything out of whack, and you could definitely see the president getting the margins he needs to pull that inside straight again and hit 270.
Yeah, well, like, you know, you mentioned, like, you know, looking back on 2016, I have no idea why some people were so confident of a Clinton landslide looking back on it. Like, you know, polls were very close in several of the battleground states. Like, you know, but in the Clinton campaign's defense, there was no, you know, really high quality polling in those three Rust Belt states, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. In the final weeks of the campaign, like, you know, there was really no high quality polling in those states, like, you know, leading up to the election. I think the Clinton campaign had just grown too bullish on those states to bother campaigning in them. But I believe this time around, like, you know, we're seeing polling has been much more stable. Like, you know, Biden has been sitting at like a plus 8, plus 9 national lead since the late spring, early summer. So, like, you know, President Trump this time around, like, you know, like 2016, he starts off as the underdog. Can he find a way to win? Yes, he can. But part of his problem this time is there are fewer undecided voters. Like in 2016, like you mentioned, in 2016, we saw Clinton leading, but it was like, you know, she only had like 45, 46% of the vote. So, okay, like, you know, you have a lot of undecided. So that's a potential, you have room for potentially either candidate to grow. Like this time in these battleground states and across the country, we're seeing, like, you know, Biden, like, you know, at 50, 51% of the vote, like, you know, okay, like, you know, if you're an incumbent president and your challenger is at like 50, 51% in various battleground states, that kind of, you know, is hard to make up, like, you know, with 8 days until the election. And the president also has to deal with his approval rating. Like, rarely is, like, the last I checked on 538, his approval rating was like 11 points underwater. It's kind of hard for an incumbent president to be reelected with those numbers, so.
He does have a couple of things going for him. And I tell people this when they start to think that we may be getting to the point where this thing's solidifying. I say, you got to bear in mind, he's still the incumbent. In the United States, we love reelecting presidents. We just do. You can go back and you say, well, Jimmy Carter, you know, but Jimmy Carter came in after Watergate and the country, we were in the middle of the oil embargo. There were things happening, the headwinds against him. You know, he might've been seen as a reflection of, we're tired of Nixon and Ford. Let's just cleanse the palate. And then Reagan defeats him on his reelect. After that, you have to go to George H.W. Bush, who was, for all intents and purposes, seen as a continuation of the Reagan years. So it wasn't so much that he was a one-term president. It was almost like a 12-year presidency came to an end when he was defeated. After that, you know, you go, Clinton gets two terms. Bush W. gets two terms. Obama gets two terms. We tend to reelect presidents because you do. You do have the bully pulpit of being the president, and the president also too. He's going to get a really good third quarter GDP number. Now, you want to play this into context and say, well, the first quarter was terrible. The second quarter was absolutely atrocious. This will be a bit of a reversion. It doesn't make the other two go away, but it'll look good. But yeah, that'll come right before the election. Maybe he picks up a point or two from those undecided voters who see that third quarter GDP number come out and say, okay, we're turning a corner here. Of course, I guess the other thing would be the headwinds of the fact that we're sitting here today looking at coronavirus cases going up in almost every state except for Vermont and Maine. So
yeah, I think
there's some play out there.
Yeah, like the president, one thing he does have going for him, I will give this to him, one of the things that he does have going for him is the economy. Like, you know, in today, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution released a poll in Georgia, like, you know, it had Vice President Biden up by like 1 point. It was within the margin of error. It was like a statistical tie, as the pundits like to say. But one thing he did have going for him is his numbers on the economy. Like President Trump, he was up 10 points, 53-43, on the question of who do you trust to handle on the economy. And I do think that that's one thing that the president does have going for him. Like, you know, all of, on practically every other issue, like his numbers are either statistically tied or underwater. Like on the issue of race, on the issue of the coronavirus, like his numbers there are not really the best. So, like, you know, I can kind of see why the president has been trying to shift the focus away from the pandemic, because he knows that that's not a winning message for him. His winning message is things like the economy. Like the economy, if the economy is good, then his numbers will likely improve. But outside of that, I really don't see anything else that can potentially be a winning issue for him, like, you know, with 8 days to go. So
all right, let's do some rapid fires. We try to bring this thing in for a landing. The Senate. What do you see the Senate looking like in 2021? What's the breakup there?
I think Democrats will narrowly take control of the Senate. It'll probably be like 52-48 or 51-49. I think it'll be close.
Senators out of Georgia, two Republicans, two Democrats, one of each. How do you see those races going?
That's a tough one. Like, you know, Georgia, we have runoffs. So, and those runoffs can be hard to predict. So, check back with me in December on that one. If both of them go to runoffs, check back with me in December on that one.
And okay, let's do Electoral College. Your gut tell you right now? What are we looking at numbers wise?
I think the Electoral College is going to be a Biden blowout. I think he's going to sweep most of the battleground states. Most of the states that Obama won twice and Clinton lost. Like, you know, I think he's going to flip most of those states, like Ohio, Michigan, Pennsylvania. I think Biden will get most of, not all of those states, and I think the electoral map will look pretty similar to Obama's 2012 map. So,
okay, not his 2000. His 2008 map was a lot of blue.
Yeah.
2012 was not as much, but it was, because I think he won Indiana in 2008, which
I don't think Biden's going to win Indiana.
No, he's not going to. Okay, and what do you think about the state where I'm at right now, Florida? What's your gut tell you as being a Florida adjacent?
Well, most of the polls that we've seen in Florida have Vice President Biden leading narrowly. Like I said, like we always say, it's Florida. So you have to be cautious when making predictions in Florida, because it could always go 1 or 2 points in either direction. So I think if the election were today, I think Vice President Biden would win Florida, just because his numbers with he's lagging with Latinos and Hispanics, but I think his overperformance with those older white voters that we've been talking about, I think that'll make up for it.
The danger in Florida is always, because we do straddle two time zones, you don't get the panhandle. Anything west of the Apalachicola doesn't come in till later. And that is a lot of Republican votes up there. And
yep.
I remember I was at the Rick Scott's reelection in 2014 down in, I think, Sarasota. And the numbers really looked good for Charlie Crist. And I was standing next to Will Weatherford, who at the time was the Speaker of the Florida House. And I was like, how you feeling? I mean, Crist's up pretty big. He goes, wait till the panhandle comes in. And sure enough, the panhandle came in. It came in heavy. And Rick Scott got four more years as our governor. All right, the departing question, I warned you on this one. Campaign slogan, campaign promise that is absolutely guaranteed to keep everyone, including your spouse, significant other, and your own mom from voting for you. What do you got for me?
I'd say probably, that's a tough one. Probably closing down like various fast food places, I guess. Like give me an example of this.
So my go-to is always Bigger Spiders.
Yeah.
I think Steve Shale told me banning air conditioning, which would that doom you here in Florida.
Yeah.
Matt Dixon of Politico went with releasing poisonous monkeys into neighborhoods.
Yeah. So, well, how about this? Maybe because we're coming up on winter time. Banning heat.
Winter. I've heard that word. I don't know what it means.
Oh, stop it. You're a Floridian. Stop it.
Niall, it is fantastic to finally talk to you in person. Have fun. We are, in theory, only about a week left in this election, give or take.
Yeah. Like, you know, the election is not in 8 days. The election will be over in 8 days.
Yeah. So the election started weeks ago. I voted last Monday. My wife voted last Wednesday. We're done.
So, yeah, I voted. I voted by requested a mail-in ballot and took it to one of the local drop boxes. So I'm already set. I'm all set.
We're done. We're no longer persuadable. All right. Hey, Niles, thank you so much for doing this.
Yeah, maybe we can hop back on here after the election and kind of go over everything.
Yeah, assuming we all survive. Thanks, bud.
All right. Thanks so much for having me.
All right. Niles has left to go do other things. You heard me mention in the podcast, Niles is like crazy young. Like, I mean, this is his first time voting. But one of the smartest people when it comes to election information, watching the polls and kind of deciphering it all. Somebody who's really shown a very great knack for this at a very early age. Somebody who probably has I think you could easily say has a very bright future ahead of him doing this kind of work. So, and also somebody who, much like myself, will be up late on November 3rd and probably into the wee hours of November 4th, watching returns come in as we get through the rest of this election. It is, as I'm sitting here right now, it is at 2 o'clock on Monday, the 26th. There are 8 days left in the election. If you're listening to me here in Florida, early voting will wrap up on Sunday. Monday, all of the election offices will be getting ready for the election on November 3rd, and that's your chance. So if you get a chance to go, you know, do early voting, I would say get it out of the way. Go do it when it's convenient for you. Don't wait until election day because, I mean, it's Florida. You never know what's going to happen. We get a bad storm roll in or we get those sea breezes pop up. You know, nobody wants to wait in a line in a downpour. So if the weather's nice and I'm looking outside right now, it's pretty decent. And you've got some free time, go cast your ballot. There are, again, if you're here in Florida, you're going to have all the usual slate of things. We also have 6 constitutional amendments out there. And, read up on those before you get in there because my ballot was 2 pages front and back. And, it takes a little bit of time to fill all those little bubbles in and get through all of it. So take a little bit of time, read up on it before you go, but do try and get out there, get voting before we get to the 3rd, and should make everybody's life a little smoother. Anyway, thank you so much for listening. Thank you for continuing to support the podcast. Rating, written review, you know the spiel at this point. If you can tell somebody about us to listen, that'd be even better. But thank you so much, and I will talk to you again very soon.